As we mentioned last week, we're going to break from our study in Genesis for the month of December and give some attention to some Advent themes as we prepare for Christmas. We're going to do that starting today. And I'm excited to share with you this morning. This is a passage that has kind of been stuck in my craw for a time, and it was good to spend a little extra time in study, and I'm not sure that I got it all figured out, but some interesting things, and I think it'll be, I'm excited to share with you. Hopefully you'll be excited to learn some things or to be reminded of some things if it's something you're familiar with. I'm going to stay a little basic here for the introduction. So this will be a reminder, I think, for most of you, but as you know, the Bible is divided up into two halves. There's the Old Testament and the New Testament. All 39 of the books in the Old Testament were written before Jesus was born. So those were all written B.C. The 27 books of the New Testament begin with the life of Jesus and the four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And then there are these letters written by Jesus' apostles and close followers. So a big portion of the Bible, the Old Testament, was written, in some cases, hundreds or even thousands of years before the first Christmas, before Jesus arrived on the scene in Bethlehem. And unfortunately, a lot of people kind of like skip over the Old Testament, just kind of neglect the Old Testament. And we're Christians, we read the New Testament, but there's some really important stuff in the Old Testament. Right now we're studying Genesis, which of course is in the Old Testament. Hopefully you've been able to see how relevant the book of Genesis is to life and to the Christian life. And we realized that was a something we were neglecting as a church, studying the Old Testament. So we've tried to fix that here in recent years by studying 2 Samuel, and we studied the book of Micah in Life Group last year. And we've seen that there are a number of ways that even though the name Jesus is not in the Old Testament, it's not explicitly in there, Jesus' name is not in there, that the Old Testament really is all about Jesus. It's pointing ahead to Jesus, causing us to long for Jesus. We've talked about types of Christ, things that kind of foreshadow Christ in a special way. Another feature of the Old Testament that probably many of you are familiar with that points us directly to Jesus is predictive prophecy. Predictive prophecy. That is, there are prophecies in the Old Testament, predictions in the Old Testament about a Messiah who will come that Christians believe these prophecies are fulfilled in Jesus. We call those messianic prophecies because they're prophecies about a Messiah. And there are several dozens of these predictions made, again, hundreds of years, in some cases more, several hundreds of years about a Messiah who would come to earth and be a savior and be a king. And these are not kind of vague predictions like, oh, he'll live near water, or, he'll have a family member who will have cancer or something like that. Because everybody lives near water, and everybody has a family member with cancer. Instead, these are very specific, detailed predictions that are fulfilled in the life of Jesus. If you're not familiar with this word Messiah, just put the next slide up there. The word Messiah is from the Hebrew. Its corollary is the Greek word Christ. We know Jesus, Christ is not Jesus' last name. Christ is his title. He is the Messiah. He is the Christ. And the literal English translation is anointed one, okay? So those words are the same. Messiah is the Hebrew, Christ is the Greek, and the English translation is anointed one. I'm going to remind you of a couple examples of these messianic prophecies. In Genesis, back in chapter 3, when we studied that, remember we read about when God was declaring the punishment or judgment on the serpent, he said that there will be this seed of a woman who will come and he will crush the serpent's head, even as his heel would be bruised. And that is the first hint of this coming serpent killer. Somebody will come and crush the serpent. Later in the book of Zechariah, there are prophecies about a Messiah who will ride into Jerusalem on the colt of a donkey. And that's fulfilled in the gospel in the book of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, fulfilled in Jesus' life. There's also a prediction in Zechariah that the Messiah will be betrayed for 30 pieces of silver, or valued at 30 pieces of silver. Again, that's the exact amount that Judas betrays Jesus for. If you read Isaiah 53 and Psalm 22, you'll read, again, hundreds of years before crucifixion is even a thing. Nobody's invented crucifixion yet. And then there are these detailed predictions about the way that the Messiah will die, that he'll be pierced for our transgressions and crushed for our iniquities, and he'll be nailed to a tree. How do you account for these things? And we'd say it shows the divine authorship of the Bible. A number of these messianic prophecies, again, there are several dozen of them that are fulfilled in the life of Jesus. There are a number of them that are prophecies made about the birth of the Messiah, or the kind of the bloodline of the Messiah. And so these will come up on the screen also. If you remember in life group last year when we studied Micah, there's a prophecy in Micah chapter 5 that the Messiah would be born in Bethlehem. What do you know? Jesus is born in Bethlehem. We read in Jeremiah that he'll be from the line of David. The Messiah will be from the line of David. 2 Samuel, that he'll be a king forever. Genesis 49, we'll read that the Messiah will be from the tribe of Judah. And Jesus is indeed from the tribe of Judah. There are a number of predictions in the book of Isaiah about the Messiah, that he'll be born of a virgin, that he'll be Emmanuel, God with us. And we know that's true about Jesus. Isaiah 9, unto us a child is born, and he'll be mighty God and Prince of Peace. He'll sit on David's throne. These are fulfilled in Jesus. The Messiah will be preceded by a forerunner, a voice of one crying in the wilderness, prepare the way of the Lord. And that's fulfilled in John the Baptist, who comes before Jesus. And so I don't know if you've ever given much attention to these, but this is one of the features of the Bible, features of the Christian faith, that is really bolstering to my faith. It really helps me have confidence that there's something unique about this book. There's something special about it. There's something behind this book. There's an author, capital A, behind the human authors that has woven it all together. I think I've given you this statistic before. In the book More Than a Carpenter, Josh McDowell says that the chances of one man fulfilling even 8 of the prophecies surrounding the Messiah's birth is by chance alone. The odds is 1 in 10 to the 17th. 1 in 10 to the 17th of somebody fulfilling these, even 8 of these prophecies by chance. And he says that is the equivalent of putting a 2-foot-high layer of silver dollars across the entire state of Texas, then mark 1 of those 10 to the 17th silver dollars, and have a blindfolded person walk in and pick the right one. What are the chances that somebody could pick just the exact right silver dollar on the whole state of Texas covered 2 feet deep? And so as Christians, we would say it's not coincidence. It's not coincidence, not by chance, that somebody would fulfill these prophecies. It's because Jesus is God. It's because this is God working out his plan. Nobody has to fulfill it by chance, because it's part of what God is doing, what God is accomplishing. I'm going to introduce you this morning to another less well-known, maybe less obvious prophecy. It takes a little more work, and there's even a little math involved, not calculus, math that I can handle, so most anybody can handle it. But I think it's really exciting. Again, some of you are probably familiar with this, but if you're not, I think you're in for a treat. So you can go ahead and open to Daniel chapter 9, and we're going to be in verses 20 to 27. Just a little bit of background about Daniel. This is the Daniel that many of you know from kids' Bibles, Daniel that was in the fiery furnace. We read about Daniel and his 3 friends, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Remember, Daniel ends up in the lion's den. Daniel is actually in captivity in Babylon after the destruction of Jerusalem by Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar is the leader of the Babylonian Empire, and this is a pagan nation, a pagan king. And so Daniel's city is destroyed. He's yanked away from his family and taken off to Babylon to serve in Nebuchadnezzar's courts. And we know that the book of Daniel was written between 586 BC and 500 BC. 586 BC is when the city of Jerusalem fell. We know many people are familiar with the stories of Daniel, again, that you might read in a kid's Bible. But that's actually only the first half of the book. The second half of the book of Daniel is prophecy. It's straight just prophecy. It's not really telling stories about Daniel and his friends anymore, but giving prophecies about what God is up to, and you know, other messages from God. So that, for that reason, Daniel's included in the major prophets. He's included with Isaiah and Jeremiah and Ezekiel among the major prophets. Okay, just to give you a little context before we get in, Mike, when before he prayed there, introduced that, that Daniel has actually been in the early part of chapter 9 praying. And the reason that Daniel's praying, again, he's not in his homeland. He's captive in Babylon, and he's grieved. He's grieved because God's people, the Israelites, are not in their homeland. The temple has been destroyed. The city of Jerusalem has been destroyed. And the reason that God allowed for these, for Jerusalem and the temple to be destroyed is because the people had fallen into idolatry and wickedness and sexual immorality. And so God's using Babylon actually to punish his people. Providentially, God is using Babylon and Nebuchadnezzar to punish his own people. And we know from the prophet Jeremiah that, that this captivity in Babylon for God's people will last 70 years, and that then they'll come out of captivity, come back to their homeland, and begin to rebuild Jerusalem. And so in the early part of chapter 9, we're going to start in verse 20, but in the early part of chapter 9, we see that Daniel is broken. He's grieved about his people's sin. He's confessing the sin of the nation. He's pleading for God to act, to do something, to restore his glory, to restore his people, to have the city of Jerusalem rebuilt. And so we see that Daniel is a man of faith. He's a man of a trusting God. He's got deep devotion to God, deep trust that God's in charge and working a plan. And now he's going to, as he comes out of this prayer, he's going to have a visit from an angel. And with a very specific message. And again, this is all about 500 years before Jesus. So just to remind you of that. Well, let's start in verse 20. While I was speaking and praying, Daniel says, confessing my sin and the sin of my people Israel and making my request to the Lord my God for his holy hill, while I was still in prayer, Gabriel, the man I had seen in the earlier vision, came to me in swift flight about the time of the evening sacrifice. He instructed me and said to me, Daniel, I have now come to give you insight and understanding. As soon as you began to pray, an answer was given, which I have come to tell you, for you are highly esteemed. Therefore, consider the message and understand the vision. So Daniel's prayer is interrupted. He's just finishing his prayer when this angel Gabriel shows up. We know the angel Gabriel from the Christmas account in Luke's gospel. He comes to visit Mary, right? This is just 500 years earlier. And Gabriel says, Daniel, as soon as you started to pray, God gave me a message to bring to you. It's the answer to your prayer. So God hears Daniel's prayer and now is bringing the answer. He's coming to bring the answer that will give Daniel insight and understanding, according to verse 22. And here's the prophecy, starting in verse 24. 70 sevens are decreed for your people and your holy city to finish transgression, to put an end to sin, to atone for wickedness, to bring in everlasting righteousness, to seal up vision and prophecy, and to anoint the most holy. Know and understand this. From the issuing of the decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem until the Anointed One, the ruler, comes, there will be 7 sevens and 62 sevens. It will be rebuilt with streets and a trench, but in times of trouble. After the 62 sevens, the Anointed One will be cut off and will have nothing. The people of the ruler who will come will destroy the city and the sanctuary. The end will come like a flood. War will continue until the end, and desolations have been decreed. He will confirm a covenant with many for 1 seven. In the middle of the seven, he will put an end to sacrifice and offering. And on a wing of the temple, he will set up an abomination that causes desolation until the end that is decreed is poured out on him. Okay. If you're like me, I remember the first time reading this and just kind of being a little bit weirded out. What are all these numbers? What is an abomination that causes desolation? What are some of these things? It seems almost cryptic and code-like. I don't think that would have seemed that way to Daniel. I think Daniel would have understood. Maybe it would have taken Daniel some work too, but I think he would have understood. God communicates to us clearly. I think he wanted Daniel to know exactly what he was talking about. But since we're separated by so many hundreds of years, it does require some work on our part. And I'll just say there are some things in this passage that are a little controversial. I'm going to do my best, and we can talk about specifics later. But I think there's some good stuff here, and plenty that is agreed upon here. The first thing I want to note is that this is just good news. God loves to give good news. Remember, he tells the shepherds that this is good news of great joy for all people. God loves to give good news, and he gives good news here. And so if you look at verse 24 and just skip over the numbers, we'll get to the numbers, but just to skip over that for now, the message that Daniel gets is really good news. To finish transgression, to put an end to sin, to atone for wickedness. This is good news. This is the thing that Daniel's grieved about. His sin and the sin of his people. And he's hearing now from the Lord this message through the angel Gabriel that sin will be dealt with. It will be ended. Okay? God's working a plan. As bleak as things look when you're in captivity, God's in charge. And so there are actually six things that are promised here that will happen. And there some of them are related. And again, if you're looking back at the Old Testament through New Testament lens, knowing what Jesus did on the cross and through his resurrection, this all makes sense. This is talking about Jesus. So after these 77s, and we'll talk about what those are, transgression will be finished. Sin will be ended. Somebody will come and atone for wickedness. Somebody will bring in everlasting righteousness. Somebody will seal up vision and prophecy. To seal up means to finish up. It'll be done. You finish it. You tie the trash bag and put it out. It's sealed. It's done. To seal up vision and prophecy. It will all be fulfilled. To anoint the holy or the most holy place, depending on how that's translated. And so people will look at this, again, Christians will look at this and say, yes, this is something that Jesus did. This is something that Jesus accomplished. And they'll say maybe part of it he accomplished in his first coming and some of it he'll accomplish in his second coming. Or they'll try to figure out exactly what those are referring to. But this is something that obviously is pointing ahead to the work of Jesus. And so how will these things be accomplished? How will they come about? And verse 25 and 26 tells us. He says, no one understand this. From the issuing of the decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem until the anointed one, the ruler, comes, there will be seven sevens and 62 sevens. So the whole thing centers on this anointed one, this ruler who will come, this anointed one. And again, Christians are on alert. We know who the anointed one is. We know who the Messiah is. We know who the Christ is. That's Jesus. He claimed to be the Christ. He referred to himself using that kind of language. And so we know this is referring to Jesus. So all of this stuff, this good news that's going to happen, Daniel didn't know the name Jesus. He just knew that there was a Messiah coming. We know that it's about Jesus. And the answer that Daniel gets, there are several things that are going on here. The first, again, Daniel's chief concern initially was the rebuilding of Jerusalem. And God has something even better in store. God's going to say, yep, I'm going to allow the temple to be rebuilt, but there's something even better. There's something even better than rebuilding Jerusalem. Well, let's talk about the numbers here. What is a seven? The word translated sevens here, it depends on your translation. Sometimes it's translated week, 70 weeks. The word week here is the Hebrew word Shabuah, and I don't know if I'm saying that right, Shabuah. And it refers to a period of 7 years. So even though it's the word week, which we associate with 7 days, it's actually 7 years. And the same word is used in the book of Genesis. And go ahead to the next slide here. And this is the same translation. So I'm not sure why they translated it sevens in Daniel and week in Genesis. But you remember the situation here where Jacob is working for Laban to marry his daughter. He wanted to marry Rachel, and so he had to work for 7 years, and then, you know, Laban pulled the trick on him. He had to work 7 more years. But read this with me here in verse 26 of Genesis 29. Laban replied, "It is not our custom here to give the younger daughter in marriage before the older one. Finish this daughter's bridal week, then we will give you the younger one also in return for another 7 years of work." So he associates this bridal week with 7 years of work. And Jacob did so. He finished the week with Leah, and then Laban gave him his daughter Rachel to be his wife. So this 77s, these sevens are weeks of 7 years, if that makes sense. I don't know if this is confusing, but the 77s are 70 groupings of 7 years. 70 groupings of 7 years. And so there are several numbers mentioned in here. There's 77s, that's the whole thing, 70 weeks. But then there's also these smaller breakdowns. There will be seven sevens first. That would be seven groupings of 7 years. That's 49 years. 7 times 7 is 49. And then there's talk of 62 sevens. And when you add that up, that's 69 sevens. And then there's this 1 week that's talked about at the end of the passage. So here's what is going on. It says, after the anointed one, the ruler comes, there will be seven sevens and 62 sevens. So this first breakdown of seven sevens of 49 years has to do with the rebuilding of Jerusalem. In other words, when the Babylonian captivity ends, after this period of 49 years from the start date is, according to verse 25, the issuing of the decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem. 49 years after that, the city will be, it will have been rebuilt. It says it will be rebuilt with streets and a trench, but in times of trouble. And sure enough, that is how it came to be. That is how it came to pass. And so God is answering Daniel's prayer. Daniel's praying that when will, you know, restore your glory, restore your city, restore your people. And God says, yeah, it's going to happen in 49 years. And it did. God knew. God knew the future. He's omniscient. But he doesn't spend a whole lot of time on that. He rushes on to, after, I've got bigger things to tell you. There's these other 62 sevens that are going to come after that. So after those 49 years, then there's going to be more years. And 62 times 7 is 434 years. So after that, there's going to be something even more important that's going to come. And that is the arrival of the Anointed One, the Messiah. So he says in verse 26, after the 62 sevens, the Anointed One will be cut off. That is, the Anointed One will be killed. He'll die. And there's, maybe this would rattle Daniel. He's the Messiah. He's the Anointed One, but he's going to be cut off. He's going to be killed. How is this going to work? How is God going to accomplish his plans despite the Messiah being killed? You almost get the sense that God is just hardly able to contain himself. He's like, yes, Daniel, I'll throw you a bone here and answer your prayer about rebuilding the temple or rebuilding the city of Jerusalem. But I've really got something bigger I want to tell you. I see something farther into the future, something that I'm up to, something bigger than coming out of captivity and rebuilding Jerusalem. That'll be great, but I have even bigger plans. I have plans to redeem sinners. I have plans for the Messiah to come and to save people from their sins, not just to rebuild a city. Rebuilding a city is great. Coming back into Jerusalem, that'll be wonderful. But I'm going to purify a people for myself. I'm going to do something that, if you could just see it now, it would be astonishing. And so Daniel's getting this message from Gabriel, again, who had been sent by God. And Daniel then later wrote it down for us to read in our own Bibles about the coming of the Messiah. And there's this detailed prediction then of the exact timing, the time frame. So again, these other predictions about the Messiah deal with that he's going to be from the tribe of Judah. He's going to be from the line of David. He's going to be born in Bethlehem. But this one actually gets to the timing. When is it going to happen? Did you know that? That the Old Testament actually predicts when the Messiah will come and when he will be killed. So it's not just a vague like, oh, this is going to happen sometime out there in the future. It's predicted very clearly. So I want to just get into the math here a little bit. Go ahead to the next slide. So these seven sevens and 62 sevens add up to 69 sevens. That is 69 groupings of 7 years until the Anointed One comes and is cut off. Okay? When you multiply that out, that's 69 times 7. That's 483 years. 483 years. Again, the start date is when this issue, the decree is issued to rebuild Jerusalem. And we know when that is. I'll tell you about that in a moment. So 483 years from the date when this decree is issued to rebuild the temple, or I'm sorry, to rebuild Jerusalem. 483 years from then is when the Messiah is going to be presented and then cut off. Okay, 1 year in Daniel's time would have been considered 360 days. We have a different calendar now, 365 days in our year. They used lunar years, lunar referring to the moon. Okay, and so when you multiply that out, 483 years times 360 days is 173,880 days. So 173,880 days after the issuing of this decree to rebuild Jerusalem, the Messiah is going to be cut off. Okay, let's look at it on a timeline here. So keep that number in mind. 483 years, 173,880 days. Again, we know historically when this decree was issued. It was issued by Artaxerxes to Nehemiah. Go ahead and put that next slide up there. The issuing of the decree to rebuild Jerusalem after Babylonian captivity is, you can read about that in Nehemiah chapter 2, verses 1 through 9. It's also confirmed or corroborated in other historical sources. So we know when that was, and the date, you can actually pinpoint the exact date. It's March 14th, 445 BC. 445 BC is when that decree was made. Okay? So from that date, March 14th, 445 BC, if you count ahead 483 years or 173,880 days, you arrive at April 6th, 32 AD as a date when the Messiah, the anointed one, will be presented and then cut off. Okay. Again, we can, like, the math here, I'm not original to this. There's different ways of kind of formulating this. This is one I think works really well. There's some other ones that, there's some other ways of kind of going about figuring out these dates and stuff. I think this is a really good one. This one was, according to Robert Anderson in the British Royal Observatory. It's been around for a while, and I think it's pretty useful for our purposes here. So, April 6th, 32 AD as the date, predicted by Daniel 500 years earlier when the Messiah will be presented and then cut off. And if they go back and look at how the calendar would stack up, go to the next slide, that would be Palm Sunday, the week before Jesus dies. So remember Jesus riding into Jerusalem on the colt, being presented as the Messiah to the Jewish people, and then a week later he's cut off. And so, again, it seems like Daniel gets this message from Gabriel, and the timing is just exactly right. Okay? Go ahead to the next slide. So, again here, Daniel delivered a specific prophecy about the time of the Messiah's death, and since the Messiah had to be alive in order to be killed, it also gives us a time frame for the Messiah's birth. Does that make sense? In other words, when Daniel gave this prophecy, the Messiah couldn't have come in 200 years because he would have had to live for another 283 years before he would be cut off. The prophecy couldn't come true 500. The Messiah couldn't come 500 years later. That would be too late. So God has this time frame. He's got it all mapped out. God is painting a marvelous picture, and he gets every detail right. So Daniel's prophecy is, again, perfectly fulfilled in Jesus. He gets the timing exactly right. So God not only knows the Messiah, where he will be born and from what bloodline he'll come, what tribe he will be a part of, but also the exact date, the exact timing. Just want to suggest that this is kind of helps complete, again, kind of fill in the, as a puzzle piece to fill in some things, maybe help explain some things that the New Testament talks about. So, for example, go ahead to the next slide there. In John chapter 2, when Jesus is at the wedding feast and he turns the water into wine, when Mary first approaches Jesus about the wine, there's not enough wine, Jesus says to her, "My time has not yet come. My time has not yet come." It seems that Jesus is aware that there's this time schedule, there's this framework, that he's got to die on exactly the right day. For him to die on exactly the right day, he has to be born at the right time. And then some other things have to happen at the right time for it all to schedule out perfectly. And so Jesus is conscious of that. So he says to Mary, "My time has not yet come." Now, we know he does the miracle anyway, so I'm not sure exactly how that shakes down. What rearranging there had to be, I don't know if that's the right word. But Jesus is aware of this time frame, this schedule he's got to keep. Other times where Jesus does a miracle and he tells people, don't tell anybody what I've done. Why is it that Jesus wouldn't tell anybody when certain people told about the miracles? There could be a number of reasons, but one that has been suggested is that Jesus knew this time frame. And if it kind of like everything came out too early, that would start the controversy too early about who he is. And maybe he would be killed ahead of schedule, but he's got to die on the Passover. He's got to die on, you know, exactly the right distance out from Daniel's prophecy, because that's the promise God made. So perhaps this Daniel prophecy helps us, you know, understand some of these things about the timing that Jesus talks about in the New Testament. Daniel's prophecy about the timing of the Messiah's coming and the Messiah's death also perhaps helps us understand how the Magi knew to come to Bethlehem in the first place. We know that the Magi knew, even though they're not Jews, from all we can tell, they're not Jews. They're from the East. We know that they knew Micah's prophecy about the Messiah being born in Bethlehem. It seems also likely that they would have known then about Daniel's prophecy and would have had some idea about the timing. Not only did they know they would have to go to Bethlehem, but also they had a kind of an idea that it was going to happen in their lifetime. The Messiah would come in their lifetime, not just to Bethlehem whenever, someday, but in their lifetime. They knew these dates. They knew these details. And so they knew when to come. A couple other scripture references there. Romans 5:6, you can see there. You see, at just the right time, when we were still powerless, Christ died for the ungodly. You might think of that as at the right time for us. It was our right time because we were so desperate in our sin, while we were still powerless. But I think you can also understand that as being at just the right time on God's timetable, on God's schedule. It's just the right time because God had it all mapped out. He sent his son at just the right time to die at just the right time on that Passover in fulfillment of the Passover lamb. Galatians 4:4-5. When the time had fully come, God sent his son, born of a woman, born under the law, to redeem those under the law that we might receive the full rights of sons. When the time had fully come, at just the right time, when the time had fully come, God's exactly on schedule. Okay, I'm going to get to some application here. I just want to say a word. I'm skipping over deliberately here, just not nearly enough time to go into this. There have been books written about the last week, Daniel's 70th week. It hasn't happened yet, or has it happened yet? There are some disagreements about the nature of that 70th week. So 69 sevens, that 483 years until the Messiah comes and is cut off. There's this 1 week left. And there's all kinds of different interpretations about that. This abomination that causes desolation. Just as a comparison, that phrase, abomination that causes desolation, that's actually referenced by Jesus in Matthew chapter 24. So it seems like that hasn't happened yet, although maybe there was a partial fulfillment in the first century, some people are going to say. But that abomination that causes desolation seems like refers to something that happens at the time of the end, the time of the tribulation, or this time, this kind of chaotic, violent time at the end of the age, before Christ's return, and that, so it's referring to the Antichrist. So I'm just going to leave that alone. I know that probably maybe opens a can of worms for some people, but I'm just going to leave that alone. There's a lot more to go into that. Maybe some other time we can spend time talking about Daniel's 70th week. But for our purposes, since we're in a Christmassy season here, we're going to just look at those 69 weeks that we've talked about. Okay, I hope I've explained it clearly. I don't know that I have a complete grip on it. There could be some things I need to be corrected on here. But what I do know is that God has kept his promise to Daniel. God has fulfilled this prophecy through sending his son at just the right time. And so here's some application, and will lead us into our time of communion, celebrating communion. The first application is just to be filled with awe. To be filled with awe. Sometimes we have to allow ourselves to be astonished. We kind of live in this culture that's all about shock value, and, you know, this YouTube video went viral in the news. They kind of like sensationalize everything, and we've kind of almost lost our ability to be startled, to be astonished. And I think this is an appropriate one. If this is new, even if it's not new, we ought to be astonished that God had it all mapped out. God had this big, perfect plan. He makes promises and he keeps promises. He's sovereign over history. He's powerful. He's working a plan. He's wise enough to use even our free choices, even our sinful free choices, and weave them all together into this beautiful tapestry of His grace on display. He's loving enough to give us these prophecies in the Bible so we can see it, so we can know, so we can believe, so we can have confidence. So just be filled with awe that God knows what He's doing. He's been up to this. This whole plan that culminates in Jesus being born in Bethlehem and then later the cross and resurrection, it's not something like God just threw together at the last minute. It's been His plan all along. And actually, it started even before Daniel. He's had this plan since before the creation of the earth. God's known He was up to this was what He was going to do. This is His plan all along. A second application from this passage in Daniel, this prophecy about the timing of the Messiah's arrival, is that I think this should give us great confidence that Jesus really is the Messiah. We should have great confidence in the reliability of the Bible and just the truth of Christianity in general. There is no other religious book, not the Quran, not the Book of Mormon, not the scriptures of Hindu or Buddhists, that is comparable to the fulfilled prophecy in the Bible. There's nothing like it. There's just nothing like it. You do your research. There's nothing like this. These detailed descriptions, these detailed predictions of this Messiah who will come, again, hundreds of years before Jesus shows up. There's just nothing like that. And so I think this should give us great confidence that the Bible is a divine book. It's not just a book written by men about God. It's a book written by God to show us what He's like. So it should give us confidence in the Bible. It should give us confidence that Jesus is the Messiah. Again, Jesus claimed to be the Messiah. His followers believe that about Him. Will somebody come along and fulfill these prophecies in the Old Testament better than Jesus? You know, there are some people that are still waiting for the Messiah to come. Is somebody going to come along and fulfill these prophecies better than Jesus? In a more detailed and more specific way than Jesus did? Some people are going to dismiss the whole idea of prophecy. For a long time, they thought the skeptics would say, well, these things must have been written before, these things must have been written after Jesus came, kind of like retroactively, to kind of make it look like Christianity has more reliability than it really does. But after the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls, there's no doubt about it. These things were written when we believe they were written. These things really were written hundreds of years before Jesus. And people are still going to be desperate to explain this away. No way. They were just lucky guesses. It was coincidence. It was all made up. How could Jesus, if He was just a man, how could He have controlled where He was born or when He was born? Do we have control over those things? Of course not. Well, maybe the Jesus' followers kind of made this stuff up to make it look like, you know, their Messiah was you know, really was who He said He was. Maybe they were kind of helping Him out along by helping Him fulfill these prophecies or kind of fabricating some things. Why would they make it up? Why would they make it up? All it got them was death. It got them martyrdom. They died for it. Not one of them recanted. Not one of them said, well, we'll take it back. We were making it all up about Jesus. We were making it all about this resurrection and fulfilling all these prophecies. None of them recanted. The best explanation, Jesus is the Messiah, the Bible is God's Word, and we should have great, great confidence. The Christmas story is not a fairy tale. It's real. It really happened, and it's on God's schedule. Okay, last application here, again, this will take us into communion, is just to rejoice in Jesus' coming and His fulfilled mission. Again, what are the details that we learn about this anointed one who would come? What did He come to do? Remember those promises? Jesus is this anointed one is referred to as a ruler, a king. How many Christmas songs sing about Jesus as a king? He's Lord at His birth. We sing in Silent Night, Jesus, Lord at Thy birth. He came to be a ruler. He came to finish sin. Isn't that what He said on the cross? It is finished. He came to put an end to sin. Does that sound good to you? Ever have that? Or are you just weary of your own sin? I get weary of other people's sin. I get weary of sin out in the world, but I'm weary of my own sin. And Jesus says it is finished. Daniel prophesied that, the Messiah would come and finish sin. And not only to finish sin, to make an atoning sacrifice, but also to bring righteousness. To bring righteousness, to fulfill all that he had planned, to fulfill all that he had purposed. Jesus came to die. If you, somebody might think, well, we're talking about Jesus being born and babies in a manger, and isn't it kind of inappropriate or something to like start talking about Jesus' death? Let's keep it cute. Let's keep it sanitized and clean. Is it appropriate? Doesn't it kind of ruin the innocence and the purity of the baby? And I'd say, not at all. Not at all. Jesus would not have seen it that way. It's not muddying the waters to say that Jesus came to die. That's what Jesus said about himself. He said he came to die. In fact, kids, if you're in hockey, if you're playing Wings and Wheels hockey, your memory verse for this week, I'm going to give it to you before you even have practice, okay? This is what Jesus said about himself and the reason he came. He refers to himself as the Son of Man. He says, the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. Jesus was born to die. He was born to do other things too, but he was born to die. And so we link these together, the manger and the cross. They go together. Christmas and Good Friday. Christmas and Good Friday and Easter Sunday. They all fit together because this is how God mapped it out. This is how he would accomplish redemption. This is how he would accomplish the salvation of sinners. And so that is the awesome thing about Christmas. Not only this prophecy, the getting the timing right, that's startling and it should inspire awe. But man, we should rejoice. This is what the Messiah came to do. He came to put an end to my sin and to your sin through his death and resurrection. That's what we celebrate at communion. He came to do for us what we could not do, what we would not do, what we would not even want to do. He came to die for us. He came to rescue us. As we celebrate communion, I'm going to have a song playing called Born to Die. It's by Bebo Norman. These lyrics will be on the screen, come up on the screen. You can listen for these when the song's playing as we go up and take the bread and the cup. He sings, and the angels filled the sky. All of heaven wondered why their king would choose to be a baby born to die. And then the bridge of the song, it says, to break the chains of guilt and sin, to find us here, to pull us in, so we can join in heaven's song and with one voice around the throne, it goes on. Isn't that good? To know that Jesus came for us. He came to die.